Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast, the Rhetoric Files, the Rhetorician Files. This is another in our series of close-in encounters, close encounters of the fourth kind. I don't know what number this would be, but where we talk directly to rhetoricians. I talk directly with rhetoricians, and we dive into topics. Once again, we're back with Dr. Dave Payne, who I've known for, let's see, we met when I was 20.
A while.
21. So 37 years.
Wow.
Well, that's the aggregate time, but the amount of time, like, well, there's 2 years at Texas and then 4 years at, and yeah.
So. Right. Not 37 continuous years, right?
We haven't talked every day for 37 years, put it that way. That'd be a lot of podcasts.
There you go.
So, again, this is the Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. The Rhetoric Warriors Project is to try to give people a deeper understanding of rhetoric so that they can go out and defend themselves against what has seemed to be a fairly nefarious rhetorical project of the right and just in general of sort of blowing people's brains apart, I think, with the digital media and the new emergence of the public discourse streams that we've got right now. So we're kind of, this is our second episode on propaganda, and we're going to try to dial that in a little bit harder, I think would be useful this time. I did a tweet this week, David, that conflation is humanity's biggest problem.
Okay.
And I start thinking about this in the sense of, especially with digital media, everything gets blended together and we don't have a critical apparatus for separating it out. Even the, you know, going back to the basics of rhetoric of define the terms, right? So pull propaganda out, you know, and separate it from brainwashing or manipulation or advertising or subliminals, all these things that are somewhat involved, you know, in propaganda, can be absorbed into propaganda. But what happens now, and you said this before we were starting to talk, is that people get a little bit of theory. Like, oh, it's all propaganda. You can't trust the government. And they just stop right there. And that becomes a real problem, I think, when people, when we start to talk about propaganda. So that's what we're going to launch in today.
Yeah, I agree. Conflation, huh? I think maybe that's countered or not countered, but accented on the other side by what I've called hardening of the categories. A lot of times our critical apparatus that try to make these distinctions become rigid. people don't see the crossover. Our analytic skills are nullified by too strict a set of categories.
I think both of that.
Getting too definitional about some of these things incurs that risk. So.
Yeah, clearly both extremes on that continuum are true. My problem is that people don't, like, you have to kind of start with, when I talk to people, going into their blended world, their conflated world, and just be like, okay. So like one of the things that's happened to you is that they've flipped this kind of paranoia on you. So the right has flipped paranoia so that now you see liberals and Democrats and maybe good-meaning, well-meaning people, doctors and scientists as the enemy. Like, how was that done to you? How did they conflate those two things and turn them upside down? And so just even having some kind of hardened category of a term that you can hold them to and train them a little bit seems to be kind of a prerequisite for having these conversations.
Well, yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think it is helpful to have, an increased vocabulary for, you know, things like strategies and tactics. So arming people. Maybe the boundaries of propaganda, what is and isn't really that helpful of a tool, as long as we're aware, as we, you know, as responsible users, what we're really basically saying when we say use that term, you know, there's something intentionally misleading or bad, right, about that message, right? Something suspect. So it's what then one does with that suspicion. So then maybe, your project to sort of not complicate that, but then to educate people to particular kinds of strategies is giving them you know, basic critical vocabulary for noting and observing.
Well, I think it's interesting. I think you are an intellectual Picasso, and you know, you already break it apart, and you see like, oh yeah, the categories are arbitrary, and that causes limitations to how you're going to see this stuff.
Sure.
Before people again can even see like the you know, the realistic paintings themselves, I'm just fascinated by how many of my acquaintance friends, professional friends, people that I know through other areas are getting absorbed into the topsy-turviness of, you know, Biden somehow being the evil giant behind all this, or, you know, the government now becomes the issue behind masking and vaccine and all this stuff. And it's playing out in really, you know, dangerous ways in the culture itself.
Yeah, you know, that is part of the problem is, you know, one person's truth is another person's propaganda, I guess. Because part of it, you know, we always want to talk about it as sort of a top-down influence, that people say things that in such a way that make others believe them in an aggregate way, that is true. That is kind of an awareness that you need to have, but that isn't exactly how it always happens. And so, you know, part of the critical model of getting away from, oh, Hitler made a bunch of normal Germans jump around differently than they did before because he had magical powers of speech or whatever, you know, getting away from that kind of magic persuader model. And I guess what you're saying reminds me of that I heard someone say online, you know, well, the problem here is that people will just believe anything that Biden says. And that just strikes me as such a curious statement, because I think it is just that Biden, who's not possessed of any magical qualities, I'm
right. Yeah. He's so banal.
Saying what a lot of people think is the right answer, that, you know, there, and that's two dimensions to simplify it. One is he says what we think is appropriate for a president to say. And two, he's trying to basically say what a general consensus of how should we think about and talk about, you know, these kinds of problems. And 59% of the people seem to be finding that repressive, while the same old 40% are seeing that as propaganda. And if you then kind of try to flip that around to always talk about Trump as though Trump comes up with stuff and makes, you know, unequipped people believe it, I've never felt that was really quite so true, that Trump really says what a lot of people already think. And the real problem is figuring out how did they come to think that? I don't see him as really a creative genius at all. In other words, most of the stuff that he picked up and poached was out there somewhere. And he just was one of the few people who would say it out loud and in public, and that became heroic for people of that point of view. Now, there's some slippage in all of those descriptions, right? There clearly are, you know, propagandists working for Trump that are coming up with stuff.
I see Trump as an actor. You know, I think he's very good with script. He's very good at inhabiting script. He's got a lot of the actor skills that I worked with a lot in Hollywood, that when he wants to inhabit something, he looks like he authentically believes it. He sells it with emotion, but he doesn't come up with the script. Like when he goes off script, he has a real problem. Like the whole bleach and, you know, the light and infrared light and that kind of stuff, which apparently came from, you know, something else that he'd been told, and he was just moving it over to something else, which is what somebody who can't handle script, it's what they do. They improvise badly. But when you gave him
just,
script,
he's just completely immune to the situation that he's
in. Well, that's what actors do. Actors don't care.
I suppose, yeah.
They literally, you can push a button on a really good actor and they will go right into that emotion regardless of circumstances. You know, it's pretty cool to see. And it's something I don't think, you know, that emotional level that you never really saw in politics before.
Right. Well, maybe that's it. I you know, he seemed to, maybe he's an improv genius in terms of that particular role, you know, kind of the Colbert parody role or something. Because when you actually gave him a script of a speech that, and that's always sort of the answer to the problem. Here, stick to what we wrote. He's horrible.
Yeah, right? He can't. No,
he's absolutely horrible at it. Yeah.
Well, there are different types of actors. There are actors that stay exact on script, and then there are actors that, you know, massage the script as they go. And he was
William Shatner was a great Captain Kirk, but absolutely miserable at everything else. He's sort of Captain Kirk of this particular Star Trek.
We had a Shatner on Best Damn Sports Show, period, when I was a writer there, and we got to write a soliloquy for him where he did a Shakespearean, because he has Shakespearean background, and he did a soliloquy ode to a football under a pen light. And it was super fun actually seeing that guy say words that we had just sit there and, you know, written about 20 minutes before. He was awesome. So fun. But you see things like that, and, you know, that is, to me, that is Trump. Like, I see him bounce around through many different scripts. He gets bored very quickly, which is, you know, partly media training, partly the fact that, you know, if there's not an emotional bomb in this, there's no reason to say it. And when you look at propaganda techniques or the evolution of propaganda, you know, it's not just this kind of Nazism and the big blocky, you know, kind of stuff like that. It's reaching back into the aesthetics of narrative and digital and cable and all that kind of stuff, reality show, and importing that over here. And the fact that he could throw these emotional Molotov cocktails constantly, and that was the only thing he was interested in. That was the only thing as an actor he knew was going to get a response. And so that's all he would do. But it's a superpower that you don't see the other politicians going up and saying, okay, well, we're going to have to deal with these cocktails coming at us. You know, what's the technique for dealing with that? If you just let that exist in the world as a propaganda technique that just takes the media attention over and over and over, you're in trouble. You know, so to me, like, just labeling it like that, say, hey, here's a technique that Trump uses. He throws emotional Molotov cocktails. And just go through it over and over until people get it, you know. And clearly Biden doesn't do it in the same way. Like, it's much more muted on that side.
Right.
And so maybe that kind of training is where we start for people, so they can see that technique just flame up in front of them.
Well, I hope somewhere beyond that, there is a kind of a political maturation where, one of the questions here is, why at this particular moment does that seem especially appealing, and why does it seem to displace so many other things? Because there is certainly a destructive edge to that. I mean, those strategies work in a counter way.
There's a huge history of it.
They don't get anything done.
But so, there's a huge history of it in religion too, right? Of that kind of just blow things up. I mean, it comes from his, there's lots of that in other, it's not just digital that makes use of this technique, but you know, the whole hell and fire and brimstone and all that stuff is just emotional cocktail, you know, Molotov cocktailing.
It has a more clear agenda, I think, in terms of frightening people to behave. It's more regulatory in a fashion. I don't think that's the agenda. I think it is, it seems to be just constantly drawing attention. And I think that is the hard thing to, it displaces and distracts. And so I think once again, it sort of changes the game. It sort of changes the game. And that's maybe what has thrown everybody is how much attention do people want to pay and what do they want to see? And I think that's, you know, and I think that is a new media phenomena, that it is there constantly. And if you have that kind of consumer, that's somebody who's watching Fox News all day long, and that kind of a news cycle, then that strategy, right, it doesn't have to live a very long shelf life.
No, it literally just has to explode over and over again. I mean, Tucker.
And that seems to be part of the, a change in accountability. Okay. So you can continue to point out, well, gee, this is a contradiction. This is exactly the opposite of what was said last week. And if the, attention is simply on the drama du jour. And that's all that anybody particular needs. But once again, there are these roots back to the kind of the inherent conflict. And I guess we've noted this many times, that depends on conflict, right?
Like what? What do you, give me an example.
Well, I don't think the throw the Molotov cocktail every day just to continue to, works very well to support legislation and the legislative process across time. You're not going to build support for this bill. And we notice there weren't any introduced or passed by Trump, right? That's just not even part of the
progress. It's so. Part of propaganda, right? I guess it's both. But I use the utopian dystopian binary a lot in persuasion when I'm trying to explain it to people at a theoretical level. And the idea that of increasing the dystopia of the other side, that how dystopian they actually are, and amplifying that is clearly a propaganda agenda or a strong agenda on the right. Like, it's an attack dog, to me, like an attack dog rhetoric. That's what it does best. It stains people. It throws bombs, explodes things. It creates conflict over and over and over again. As a governing policy and all that kind of stuff, as a cognitive policy, that doesn't work. But as an emotional policy, that works just fine. Sure. Like keeping people in that emotional space of feeling threatened, feeling outraged, feeling, all those sort of really strong negative emotions as a, as a theoretical agenda, it's a very strong type of rhetoric.
Right. And I guess I would say both the utopian and dystopian depend on a kind of, what philosophers call a telos, right? That we're somehow we're all living in this ultimate end of the road kind of framework. So there's apocalyptics that are sort of fueling that. The things that we think are at stake are these ultimate kinds of outcomes, and I don't think you can underestimate the amount of apocalyptic stuff in our culture and discourse, certainly among the religious. Right. And so, you get back to Ronald Reagan. Well, it doesn't really matter about this ecology stuff because, we don't have to save the trees. They're all going to be dead in 40 years. That was kind of a slip up, but it was an early seismic register on the thinking of some people here that we are living in this kind of ultimate outcome. And certainly when you look at the rhetoric of salvation, the religious component of this, they're even down to, I think one of your guests actually made the comment that he'd been living among certain people and that one of the problems with abortion is that Jesus isn't going to come back as long as we're doing this, right? And if you think about the little dog biscuits of that are tossed into that, moving the Jerusalem, all of these, the people who are literal about the Bible and the second coming. So we tend to partition ourselves off from that kind of stuff, but that is right. part of the logos, part of the sense making apparatus of people who live in that psychosis. Okay. I don't think we can, we have to, if you're going to toss around things like dystopia and these, I think that feeds into and is fed by those larger kinds of tributaries in the culture that the sense that we are, if you think about just the notion of progress and how progressive takes on this ultimate evil on the side of the right, progress itself is one of these. Okay, we're marching toward a better future here somehow. This is the right side of history,
right?
And on the other side, no, you right side of history, wrong side of God, and that's not where you want to be. So once again, back to those strategies in religion of fear, they work because of that basic sense of where are we positioned in these ultimate outcomes.
Yeah, and I think that's really important. The the 21 Colosseums book basically sets this up as a theoretical model so that you can move back and forth between these areas of these big areas of rhetoric. So logos and, you know, all the logic and rationality world has just gotten log jammed. Like, it's really easy to log jam logic and rationality, especially with digital media and 500 different people commenting all the time, people with different levels of processing, different levels of misinformation. It's just log jammed. Mm-hmm. So you move over to something like emotionality, you know, the psyche and story, you know, which is bringing back in all that apocalyptic, you know, look at all our apocalyptic movies and, you know, all the idea that, yeah, we can still get to utopia. Like, America's, you know, genius in its storytelling is that dystopia is there 95% of the movie. And then the last 5%, you get this beautiful utopia, which is a cathartic moment for people in the storytelling, which always amazes me. Like, when I watch French movies and a lot of the European movies, they do just the opposite. They will find a way to keep you in dystopia at the end. They love a tragedy, you know, even a movie that where they've earned it, they've earned the utopia, they still don't give it to them. I'm like, but that Christian telos of moving towards either, you know, the utopian, we're doing this right by sharing our world with people and accepting new people and new viewpoints, versus we're moving away from God by allowing these vile, you know, anti-humans into our space. That is where it's being fought, right? On a propaganda level, on a story level.
Well, it's certainly a big slice of that ideological pie. For you know, many people in the electorate, that is a chunk of the base there that the right has no political future without, and that has been true since the Reagan era, I think.
And I think when I, again, in some ways it undercuts the entire project of Rhetoric Warriors, the idea that you're instructing people how to look at rhetoric intellectually, take it apart and defend themselves or create better rhetoric to fight back bad rhetoric. But, you know, the idea of if you're going to go into a story conflict where they're telling a really strong story, you can't counter that with logic. You've got to counter it with a different story. You know, and I see people do this a lot with the Jesus character of, well, I told one of my guests, would Jesus have had a gun? You know, she's pro-gun, pro, you know, all the stuff, pro-Jesus. I'm like, those things don't, it doesn't fit in the story. Right. And her head just locked.
Oh, we need some other description of our mythology, more like Neil Gaiman's American Gods, right? That we don't realize that there is a pantheon out there of different god centers, sub gods, and Jesus is only a pretty prominent component. And
even just that, right? Adding in more god stories so that there's not one, you know, monogamous or monotone, you know, monolithic God story, so that you can increase the story range for people. And Americans have done that a lot, you know, on the sort of liberal side. They're all like, well,
I mean, Jesus is kind of like the CEO of a whole chunk of stuff. If you look at the 700 club of religious businessmen, you'll see moments on there where, I remember one a long time ago, the price of gold went up, and is Pat Robertson, that it wasn't that his name, so praise the Lord, you know, the things I can do with this, and I kind of wow. certainly, you know, Jesus is the supply side. Jesus is certainly fond of business. And
well, the Joel Osteens, I don't know if you have much you've tracked that stuff, but you know, down in Houston or Dallas, can't remember, but he, you know, completely mixed in that corporate identity into religion. And people, it took them a while, I think, you know, to sort of move over to it, but it's seamless for a lot of people now.
But I think, you know, once again, if you look at the point of view of the citizen actor, right, whatever the unit of politics or the individual, they're basically not looking at this to make logical, you know, very many of them anyway, It is that they're looking to legitimize what they already do. How do I legitimize my means of support and the things I do? How do I justify the ethics, you know, that that I engage in to do the things that I do? And so that's kind of a backward-looking sense-making operation with a lot of room for inconsistency and rationalization until push comes to shove, right? Until something tries to pull those bonds and linkages apart. So once again, that's a function of, you know, as you've noted, of pointing out contradictions and ironic humor and things like that. That how did you get to this position? And that is an agitation, right?
Yeah, it's an agitation, but I think
it has to be there.
Again, when I try to train up the left to go in and recover people from the right, I try to get them to stop using logic because it's just useless. It's like putting a straw into the log jam. Like, that's not going to do anything. But go into the stories and change the image, like changing the image of Jesus and saying, you know, I don't remember him having an AR-15 in the garden when the Romans came for him. You know, and right. If you can just get them to even create that image in their head, then you've done some rhetorical work.
Sure. And you've gone back to your term for the day, conflation, right? That part of that is the conflation of all the stuff splashing onto each other. I think, you know, it's something that you and I have talked about. I think you have to appreciate, because not everyone out there, and certainly not everyone that you want to try to access here with logic or leftism or whatever, is at least virtually very few people are in that one mindset all of the time, right? They're constantly negotiating between a lot of conflicting impulses and theories, okay, and vocabularies. So people more or less move through this world of conflated stuff. So when does it become a strategy and how does one combat it? But, you know, I thinking as we talked about, what is kind of the existential position of many of the people? And it seems to me that as they deal with this conflated world and conflated ideologies, is that they're kind of paralyzed. And that a lot of people really do not have a clear program. And one of the things that I think kind of gets in the way of that is the ideology of voting itself. And that is something undergoing change here a little bit. We notice the decline in membership of both political parties and the increasing size of independents, right, as voters, people who are potentially not going to vote in one or another party line. That's more and more a political fact that people have to take. And neither party wants to talk about that because they want to see getting this many votes or that many votes as an endorsement. So that we won the election, therefore, right, that means they agree with the Democratic agenda. And of course, we're starting to see all kinds of seams in that, well, yeah, they voted for that for president, but not necessarily in their local or state elections. There's not a huge amount of consistency there. So I think more and more taking stock of what people think they're doing. We certainly have had this conversation on the Democratic left of, gee, this kind of rhetoric of moral purification that I must vote for the person who best embodies my ideals. The Bernie Sanders problem here in the most recent elections, that was historically, right, with George Bush and too many people defecting to a third party candidate. So people, right, vote feeling that they, because that is their little moral act. And they have to, when they go into the voting booth, vote with this kind of idealism. And of course, you have that on the other side as well. in the right that voting for the sort of the morally sponsored candidate. And this is a way that they deal with this kind of confusion and conflation to find some sort of ethical issue that climbs to the top. And I was reminded of my interaction with a young guy who before the election, sort of saying, well, you know, I really see both sides here. I just really, you know, don't agree with a lot of what Trump says and does. And he seems, you know, this way or that way. Yet at the same time, you know, and I agree with a lot of the things that Biden is saying, but at the same time, I don't agree with abortion. So how do they simplify? How do they come up with a basis for simplifying and reducing these to a single issue that they can get on board of, right? And this person was saying, I just don't think I'm going to vote, which I think is a common enough thing. And if you try to start dissecting this, the moral responsibility for making that choice becomes just simply paralysis, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And all the way and all the different gradations to get there. Well, okay, this way or that way. So I think a lot of people, you know, voted for Trump that don't particularly like or agree or think he's, you know, anything special. His rhetoric isn't particularly working on them. But that isn't really the salient issue for them. And so I think that's the only explanation I can come up with for how somebody can get 10 million more votes in 2020 than in 2016, yet only have a 40% popularity.
Right. So, I mean, it becomes, when you look at ease of decision systems, right? So deciding based against something, like a negative. So picking one thing that has a major negativity for you, some type of sinfulness to it, and just moving everything else out of the discussion and using that beacon so that you can make a decision. I think a lot of people did that on the left with Trump, like anybody but Trump, you know,
right.
This idea that if we can take this multivariate environment that has literally an endless number of issues and positions within those issues and everything else. And I called it sometimes the Christmas tree light, you know, version of things. You have little Christmas tree lights going up the tree. And then at the top you have the star. And so if you can use that decision system of, we find the one thing like abortion or, well, it's not Trump, that kind of stuff, that you can make a decision. You can get past that paralysis by moving all the multivariate stuff out of the way. And I see this a lot in business. I do a lot of work for clients where I have to build their messaging, whatever their persuasion is going to be. And they have to make all the decisions along the way, all the micro decisions about, do you want to say this? Do you want to say this? All the strategy, all the tactics, all the words, all the naming, all that kind of stuff. And they can't do it. They're not qualified to do it. They're not in it. And so I create a decision system where I do a point and choose decision matrix for them. I'm like, I'm going to give you three options. Just tell me the one you like, and we're going to move to the next decision. Because it's got to be that fast. And the load has to be taken, the cognitive load and the dissonance load has to be taken off, or they just lock up. And if I can choose the three, then I can guide the decisions enough to where they're not going to make a massive mistake and destroy the whole thing. So having a decision system like that laid out for people, I think becomes, again, like a really strong rhetorical technique within logic, within logos, that people could actually probably handle. You know, just don't allow anybody to start complicating it again, to start, right, you know, expanding the log jam again.
Right. Well, that sounds good. And maybe is a good, a containment strategy, because the other component of what we're talking about is, now that we know you can sort of nullify a certain number of voters or poke a hole in push a button in a certain way that is going to throw their balanced world in kilter again. You know, this is what feeds the Molotov cocktail strategy, right?
Right.
What's the last moment, right? The October surprise, the week before the election, that will do enough, because when these things are so closely balanced, as they are to each other, So, you know, once again, that rather than large scale war, this becomes a set of border skirmishes. Certainly the propagandist has a vested interest in continuing to create the confusion.
Well, I think the propagandist...
So that does, you know, a lot of the behavior we've seen is just continue to throw crap into it, right? There is no leadership here to sort this out. Except for Dan.
Yeah, except for me. Just everybody listen to me. I'll straighten all this.
I think the three-tier decision tree might be, you might be able to commodify that in a certain kind of way that becomes a certain kit for dealing with dissonant information.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of been my takeaway from going from academics and then entertainment for a long time and then going into business. Business needs actionable rhetoric, actionable strategies and tactics.
Right.
They need like 3% of what I know about something, and they don't want to hear the rest. They might be interested in it. Some are intellectual people, but it just slows everything down so much that they lock up.
Sure. Well, and that's, you know, we've had touched on that conversation. Democracy is really messy and difficult, and getting a group of people to make up their mind to do something is hugely difficult. However, making it happen and then letting people catch up to the decision, legitimizing the decision in retrospect is a far easier thing to do. Right?
And I think this idea that you start with the basis here that we're in a multivariate conflated environment, right? That's sort of the modernity principle, that what's happened is, especially through digital media, it's allowed this, I sometimes call it the unending avalanching of messaging towards the individual. And so you've got this multivariate conflated environment. The propagandist does two things, like you were saying, they stoke that. They just continually create more confusion, throw more Molotov cocktails. They want it chaotic. And right. Then in order to win, they create these pyres. You know, I think that's one of the things that you get from big propaganda, like the huge rallies and the huge symbology, to cut through that stuff. And the only way to do that is to have that sort of, you know, one pyre, that beacon, or that one character. You know, that's why it all becomes a totalitarian Hitler, because you need a symbol that's strong enough to cut through all this. So people just stop listening. They stop all the dissonance, all the multivariateness, and they look at that one symbol and they hold on to it. And I think you've seen that with Trump. You know, I think all the things that make Trump a super symbol, you know, his orangeness, his scowl, you know, the fact that he will say anything and, you know, sort of blow things up. When I see people attach themselves to that, like, they're not attaching themselves to the reality of Trump. They're attaching themselves to this character image that really is a nicely built propaganda image. That's why you can put his face onto Rambo and they're like, yeah, that's fine with me, you know? Because he has a clarity of symbol.
Sure. I guess that, once again, I'm still more, how do you lay the fire for that to work? How do you get people into such a circumstance where they're willing to do that? And I think that once again, there's how do you get them to sweep their miseries up into the pyre to ignite it, right? It's back to, once again, the most simple and obvious is the scapegoat function, where we have all of these undiagnosed and unanswered complaints and ailments and sufferings, getting everybody to point in the same direction to its cause, right? And then the joinder to that is how do you then start coming up with this composite sketch of Trump that contains these elements that are, you know, endorsable, and where you're no longer even making a cause effect distinction.
Well, maybe this is where we get this sort of collision of lived modernity and then rhetoricized adaptations or uses of that. You know, we've talked about not being able to find places that we want to live, and you know, retiring and all these different things. And you have all these different forces around you in modern culture all the time. Like even the option that you can move, you know,
right,
to
right.
limitless places, that's a stress. And so the lived experience of being in modern culture, it's one of the reasons I always like taking Newman's classes. Well, I took your classes because it, that sort of hard, you know, interaction between rhetoric and cultural studies that you see people going through these lived experiences every day of like religions breaking down, business getting into everything, new people moving into your neighborhood, media now out there 24/7. And it creates the conditions for something like this kind of rhetoric to come in and be powerful. Whereas maybe it wouldn't be if people weren't so stressed and alienated and all the things that you get from sort of modernity cultural studies.
Right. Well, and some people, you know, and people will continue to move through this with a certain amount of dissolution and dissatisfaction. You know, there's a stark reality there that, at least as you look at a number of analysts, and I was just watching a podcast this morning that seemed to make the same conclusion, if it hadn't been for COVID, Trump very likely would have won in November, despite all of this, right? Despite all of the criticism, despite all of the detachment, all the doubts, the lack of popularity, the lack of agreement, there's enough lack of, you know, it took a crisis to turn enough people in a different direction, wanting a different solution. And, you know, I think probably in 2016, that was a much different formula in the sense that we were not especially in crisis. We had certain years of stability and all economic growth and all of those kinds of things. So that had to be manufactured more. But look at how few people voted by comparison, because they didn't see that there was something at stake. So
well, I think
it's pretty complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And that's why, again, conflation, you know, when right. You start trying to pull these things apart so you can get a grip on one little thing, like the word propaganda, it's got a history to it. It's got an academic kind of definition to it. But it's got this popular usage now where they're conflating the meaning of propaganda with all influence. You know, any type of influence is now propaganda. And I saw this on Twitter or somewhere this morning where somebody had posted the picture of Schumer this weekend where he was up next to a TV watching a game or something and drinking a plant-based beer because the right had... You know,
well, he was accused of go ahead, yes.
Yeah, going after Biden for taking away, you know, making them all drink just plant-based beer. And so he was making fun of that. And somebody posted, look, propaganda, you know, built, look how close he is to the TV. It's clearly staged and all this. I'm like, yeah, it's political rhetoric, but that doesn't make it propaganda, you know? So losing that term and that term becoming so infused with so many different meanings and so many different people's approaches, it kind of becomes useless.
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of directing us to one specific kind of understanding, because propaganda would take, you know, it would creep into any kind of communication system it could, right? I mean, I think all we're doing if we invoke that term is to say, this is somehow intentional, it is biased or deceptive, and it's aimed at a kind of a result that's being disguised here, right?
But that's, don't you?
And once again, we can say that that's true. But if a politician gives a speech, you should be aware that that's what they're trying to do.
Right.
That's not an unintentional disguised.
But there's political talk and then there's influence and then propaganda, to me, we talked about this last time, has some type of political or state base. Like I don't think businesses can't do propaganda.
Well, I would take some issue with that. I think I thought about that. Once again, I think we are in an age where, you know, the writing the company history. They will hire somebody to come write a book, you know, the history of the company. and the great leaders and his past. And once again, that's not, we don't notice that because that is not propaganda that's disseminated out to the general public so much. That's for the employees and their identity. So creating a community, a culture among the organization itself is a strategy that's been popular for the last 25 years. And that is propagandistic, right?
So it's an internal government. It's an internal leader.
Well, it has the same goals, that the political goals that we have with political propaganda, right? The question is, the difference between what we just described with Molotov cocktails and creating confusion and keeping people reactive to the other propaganda function of the state, which is to keep people not involved, to keep people feeling safe and secure, and to leave it to us to take care of the problems, to depoliticize them. So I think there's two counter movements here. The traditional propaganda of the state is believe that we're good, believe that we're moral, that we're taking care of it, and you can get to your non-political life and go to work and come home happy and, you know, feed your children.
But is that propaganda?
And that's called legitimation, right?
Is that propaganda?
Please don't participate in the system.
Yeah, I get it, but those are also good messages that you'd want to hear. Hey, we have good leaders. They're taking care of these things that we can't get involved in, really. So let's just work at our lives.
Well, we didn't used to think so. We used to think, oh, if you're on the attack side of the, if you're trying to criticize the government, you go, well, you know, that's really trying to defang our political movement. I think it's, once again, it's like the North and South Pole changing positions. I think we just sort of changed the polarities here. Because that is then, the counter propagandas, whatever. And that's why the anti-movement of Trumpism has been the fueling of it. Why confusion and conflation feeds it in that kind of way. But I think of the comedian John Mulaney has this line. Isn't that his name?
Mulaney or Maloney?
Mulaney, I guess.
Yeah, the young guy.
Yeah. Yeah, in one of his very first things in the early Trump thing, he was making the point that, we talked about whataboutism. They keep pointing out that, Obama did this too. And he said, the reason why I didn't pay attention to Obama doing it was I felt like he was a good guy doing his job. And I didn't have to pay attention every day to make sure he was doing his job. That the real difference, and that's okay with me. That's what I really want, right?
Yeah, I think that's been the American political promise, right?
Right. But that is the legitimation arm of the to maintain that kind of moral authority that we don't want to be political. And I think back to propaganda and the educational system, that is one of the foremost facts is most people don't want to be political. And why their voting behavior is, and the real wonks that spend all their time online and are intensely involved in this constantly have a difficult time with the fact that most people don't really want to start paying attention to the election until a few months ahead of time. And so once again, we ask, why does the kind of the constant agitation, the constant crisis, the constant drama, pay attention become an effective strategy? It's for that reason.
So I'll give you something here. So one of the we may have talked about this before, but one of the ideas that I've in some ways started to figure out how to capitalize on or monetize is this idea of outsource your outrage. So outsource your politics. America is nothing if not the location where we pay other people to do the things we don't want to do.
Kind of like the new boxes of groceries that come to your doorstep, right?
Yeah, right. So like, you tell me what your politics are, you give me $50 a month or whatever, and I will send you letters, addresses, phone numbers, texts, sure, everything for you to send. And it'll just arrive at your door, your digital doorstep every month. And all you've got to do is just feed into your system and hit send.
Well, it could. That might be a nice metaphor to do some criticism with, finding out what kinds of messaging out there that really does that for you, right? are there particular websites that people get fond of that's essentially what they're doing?
Well, sure. Yeah. They harvest script from websites constantly.
We talked about that last time with come to find out in QAnon, almost nobody was actually following Q. It was the four or five sites that were mining that and creating a whole digestive cocktail for it that people were relying on as sort of their daily digest.
And this is also when you think about the role of the rhetorician and the fact that there are no guardians really in our public discourse. There's no judges. There are no rhetoricians sitting over it saying, "Hey, this is propaganda, guys. We're going to label it all red, and this is stuff you can kind of rely on. We're going to label it all green." Would that be a role for rhetoricians? Like, if you were in that role, would you feel adequate to be able to make those judgments and tell people, "Hey, I'm not going to be perfectly correct on everything, but you can typically listen to David Payne, and he's going to tell you, don't listen to this rhetoric over here, but this stuff, yeah, go in and harvest from, it's fine."
Well, there you go. And that should be the function of criticism as it's acted.
So we need a whole rhetorical guardian class.
I shared this, you know, the opening pages, we talk about Burke, who I think really was a pioneer and mapped a lot of the critical turf here. For modern rhetoric. But when he opens up the book with saying, okay, well, really all living things are critics. The trout who's bitten a hook will for a greater or lesser period of time manifest a revised judgment as a result of the painful experience. But then his critical project becomes distinguishing between bait and lures, right? Between bait and food. So in our cultural tangles, it becomes more, you know, back to your conflation thesis, it becomes more and more difficult to decide which is bait and which is food. And I see propaganda as kind of, this is bait, this is bait, this is bait, okay? And whatever critical vocabulary you need to point out that really you're that's just stuff in your environment, but really somebody's put that bait trap there, right?
Right.
For you to bite into as a bad truth. So that's kind of the utility of that term, is sort of level one, pointing out that stuff's going on. There are composed messages that are designed to suck you into something. And there is a coherence to that project if you pursue to look at it. So in a way, then the critical project would become with greater and greater ways of distinguishing between food and bait.
Yeah. And
cultural tangles, right?
I mean, do you think, like, when you look at this theoretically, is this asking too much of an untrained population in this sort of high volume, esoteric, high technology environment to be able to make these distinctions? And I think it seems to be like, every time I go back and start doing training with people, even just the idea of telling them, oh yeah, I've detailed 21 different coliseums, like technology is a coliseum of persuasion. If you don't understand how technology works in the persuasive messaging world these days, then sure, you're dead in the water.
And so you've got to, and that's a continual thing. The technology is continually, I mean, okay, I'm trained, but 5 years ago, I didn't really have that much of a conception of how you could hook up all of these robot servers in Facebook to echo a message throughout the culture in
right.
such a way.
Yeah, it's
somebody had to come along and map that for me.
Yeah,
and by the time another election rolls around, that, you know, they are the Cambridge Analytics phenomenon.
Right.
So once again, the ante on technology, it continues to be upped in a way that it's very difficult to keep track.
And so you would need an expert to be able to take you through that and sort of protect you from it. And the idea, like I was saying, like the idea just that there are 21 distinct camps that you can go into theoretically, not even strategy, tactics, and situations. Is that fair to hand back to somebody? Like if they read my book, they're going to walk out and go, oh, I feel good about being able to handle all 21 of these coliseums now. You know, I'm depth. I'm ready to be a gladiator in technology. I'm not. Like, I understand. I've delved into it way more than most people from a persuasive messaging perspective, but I don't understand any of the software and the real tech behind it. When I get into people who do start talking about that stuff, I'm like, wow, there's a lot here.
Well, is this kind of like a video game where there are different levels in the 21? I'm intrigued now that you have identified the 21 kind of arenas or whatever. And I guess back to, you know, once again, I'm sure video games have changed since I played them. But when my children were playing them and I participated in this, you got to kill the boss at a certain level before you get to go on to the next level and kill the boss, right?
Yeah.
I wonder if there is a kind of a like Pokemon, you can get certain levels throughout.
And I've thought about that a lot with rhetoric training, like even within logic, you know, teaching people, like they don't even know the word syllogism. They certainly don't understand first order predicates and, you know, all this sort of logic strings.
Sure.
And I'm like, maybe like having an argument with an AI bot that takes you through a logical sequence might train your mind a little bit to be able to keep evidence and claims and warrants separate so that you can evaluate each one of them. People can't even do that when you get into arguments. The lack of training in arguments, and you know, in their defense, these things get very sophisticated and very unfun very quickly. I get it. But to tell me you're going to have an argument with me and then you can't do an argument and then get mad at me for telling you that you can't do an argument kind of becomes this tautological failure that we can't get out of. You know, you get this a lot in relationships where people just jump topics when they start to lose. It's like, yeah, well, you did. And I'm like, hey, you can't jump off. I did this with, you know, different relationships along the way. I'm like doing relationship or argument training within an argument. And I'm like, no, it doesn't really work.
Well, as somebody who loves syllogisms and all that kind of logic, and for 40 years, not only at least for some time tried to teach them and then watched other people try to teach them, I don't know. Some people have that kind of wiring and some people don't seem
right
to.
But I mean, really, if you're going to deconflate a logic environment, you can't do it without that stuff.
Well, okay. I liked your three-part, you know, decision tree. What we've described here is a situation that's basically a media ecology that is gurgling and people participating in it in ways that they never have before. I think that is the modern technology. I think a lot of what we're experiencing here isn't that there's the percentage of the population thinking one way or another way has not changed radically, but in the last decade or so, more of those people are online communicating through online, internet contacts. So they're able to collectivize and voice in ways that they have not been before. So there's something kind of democratic about this. And we should be afraid of that.
Well, it's dangerous. It's a dangerous foundation.
The truth shouldn't be completely democratic. We shouldn't just necessarily vote on the truth, right?
No, multi-log environments sound democratic, but what they really are is babble and chaotic.
And there's something hugely mythic about all of that as well. But I think there is
completely hijackable.
I think there's a point there. Is that that plus economics plus, you know, the nature of the dangers that we face, climate change, global politics, it's like Tom Robbins used to say, the international situation was desperate as usual. So the amount of stuff that people are dealing with and information and science on and on and on. All these cultural tangles and conflations that we're talking about. What people are then selling to are bases for simplification. Some of those are political,
yeah,
some of those
right
are ideological in other ways. And it may well be that some companies are participating in, selling bases for simplification. The groceries that get delivered every week. So I think maybe syllogistic logic is one kind of tool or some, you know, user-friendly version of that that somebody can devise if they will. Or maybe, you know, a decision tree a la Dan that says, okay, if you can just slice part of this off and see in this a hierarchy and a sequence that will clarify or reduce the, you know, find a transcendent issues, which is interestingly, and this was kind of the slippery slope that Burke did identify as, in the technological psychosis, about the only thing you can do is come up with more technological solutions. These are technologies, right? Information technologies is the huge demand.
For sure.
And the demand is great. And I don't think academics and disciplinary studies have really been on top of that. We're still trying to make sense of it as though it were part, a natural, logical part of history when there's certain transformations that are occurring. So anyway, to work technologically on that frame and to see it makes a certain amount of sense. But to imagine that the nature of the situation that we enter, the rhetorical situation, if you will, is one where it's not that there are too few solutions to these problems, there are too many solutions being marketed to the information problem and how to simplify this into a copable truth, and to find a way to kind of cut through that noise would be one of the challenges. I guess the other way I think of that is back to the kind of, I think people are kind of becoming more and more sophisticated, but they're not quite there yet, is that we're going through a kind of an adolescent phase. You know, if you're an adolescent, you're 12, 13 years old, and all of a sudden you start figuring out that not everything they told me in church was probably right. And I'm looking here for different kinds of truths, whatever. And maybe not all adults have been as trustworthy as I thought they would. So I think there is that kind of first level skepticism and finding your way out of that forest to a more mature way of sorting through the mess for yourself is probably, you know, kind of developmentally where we are.
Yeah, I think that's a great metaphor. Like you were talking about that before we started, this idea that we're in a critical adolescence, sort of the masses. And I get this a lot. I constantly talk to people who are in some type of leadership position, if it's self-appointed in their business or, you know, something online that they've appointed themselves as having a voice, a worthy voice in. And I ask them, because they're making arguments, they're trying to sway opinions, they're attacking positions and entire groups. And I'm like, what training do you have that might help you in this? And invariably it's like, oh, I was an engineer or I was a political science major or, you know, whatever it is. It's never rhetorical training that might give them some meta awareness of the world that they're actually trying to work within. You know, and I'm like, well, maybe like a little bit of training in argument or storytelling or something like that might.
Yeah, you know, and we got to package our knowledge better too, I think, to get at this. I'm not sure we're doing all the right things. Not you and me personally, but.
I agree.
But
the adolescence is a great way of looking at that. The fact that they have adopted some critical, they're not swallowing everything whole, you know, with big open mouths. They have some critical apparatus. It's just not developed yet.
Right. It is in a frame of suspicion, but not yet finding your way out of the forest. You know, it's like Father Ong used to say, it takes, you have to know a lot to be positive. You don't have to know very much to be negative, right? But the other thing I think of on that, and I don't know if we did this before, but I did finish the seven part series on QAnon or whatever, still highly recommend. But the thing that struck me about the, I forget what they call them, Q people, Q followers, whatever, was their belief, you know, their transformational moment for themselves was, they became enlightened, sort of like their version of becoming woke, that the Q thing stimulated their critical apparatus. And now they were doing their own research. And they kept saying, I'm doing my own research now. And what kind of cracked me up about that was that really means reading several different websites that say the same thing, not necessarily finding out whether there's a factual basis for what, you know. And once again, that's another strategy to rig that system, is these websites echoing each other, right? Passing the information back and forth as though they were each sources, and then somebody thinking, well, I've done my reading here, right? I'm doing, but the point is in what you're saying is they see themselves in the driver's seat. They see themselves as, and so that is a more confirming, right? Believing in your own errors may be a good description of adolescence, right?
Yeah. And it's, I think this is, I'm going to hold on to this one for a while. We'll have to use this as one of our central tenets of this, because the adolescence stuff, I literally remember the moment of walking with you after class, my first year in grad school at UT, and we're in the building, and we're coming back from a lecture you'd just done, and just feeling my brain suddenly being open to this idea of shit, all this is constructed. And I already had an undergrad degree. I was already intellectual. I'd read everything. I was a learner. But that idea at that level of that rhetoric presents it, where it gives you some of the mapping and some of the blueprint of how that's done. Right. So it's not just this abstract, you know, suspicion. You can actually see some of the technique in it. I can physically remember that moment of going, what?
Well, I think that's right. I think some version of that is the moment. I do see that as that kind of moment of bracketing off and sort of saying, okay, this is. I think that can be translated into this kind of easy cynicism, and easy relativism that we talk about, right? Because once again, well, it's all constructed, so that means you construct it this way and I construct it that way, and gee, can't we all get along here?
That's the false equivalency problem that I keep running into this too, where people are like, my wokeness is right. The same as your wokeness, your flaws, the fact there are flaws over here, those must also exist in the exact same way over here. Like, I tried to make the point to somebody, like, you know, there are politicians who are not doing propaganda. They are trying to tell truth. They may be struggling at it or whatever, but they do exist. There have been honest politicians in the world. And they're like, no, you know, I'm like, you're false equivalencing me into having to crush you to get you to understand that these different ways of doing this do exist.
You know, are there truths that because of the way we are, they can't tell? And once again, that throws a great mirror up to Trumpism, which is sort of the adolescent joy of saying these things out loud.
Even when they're not true, at the rallies, you can feel how they're like,
and I think that is a fundamentally adolescent impulse to rebel, right? And to say things that are inappropriate, and that being, you know, cussing in public, being something that brings great pleasure and great autonomy as a 13-year-old.
It's funny. I remember Barney Downs taught performance of comedy at some point at USF, sure, and he brought me in to do a little bit of help with the students because they were doing stand-up. And then he did a stand-up night where they all got to get up and talk and do a little performance. And I don't know, 8 out of 10 of them talked about some bodily fluid, you know, whatever. And he was just aghast. He's like, you have this public forum and this is what you talk about? And I'm like, yeah, that's what they talk about. That's the beginning level of public comedy for everybody. You know, they go through sex.
We had kind of a department meeting about that, right? Where we were sort of debating that whether this was a good thing or bad thing, and the students were all, you know, this newfound freedom and authority, they were all for it. That, yeah, okay, we're saying nasty stuff, but we're digging it. And
it's just adolescent stage of stand-up. I see this everywhere when I watch people come into stand-up and they mature through it. They eventually get to, you know, their sort of middle ground where they try to take on the edgy topics, and they don't do that very well. And then the ones that are actually funny and can think their way through it just keep progressing up in the maturation until their public discourse does kind of become worth hearing. You know, it's entertaining and insightful, but most of them get arrested, you know, it's arrested development. And that's the real question is, like, I guess that the Trumpers, will they stay in this arrested development that's just going to keep voting for this, you know, rhetoric over and over and over again? Like, they do they just get stuck in that critical apparatus, or is there a way for us to continue to evolve them so that they can get to some type of maturation?
I think that's absolutely the question. I think the answer is some will and some won't if our institutions and circumstances permit higher levels of transformation. What it does, you know, the adolescent transformation does begin with this kind of ego assertion in the environment, control over the environment. That's what one is trying to learn as an adolescent to later develop into an effective adult. Politically, with others, in a socially constructed situation, that's more difficult. And of course, the power that one has, whether, you know, we talk a lot these days about giving voice to people. Some people are not voiced. And I think a lot of what the blue collar, largely Caucasian group of Trumpers is saying is, you know, we're finding our voice here.
I remember trying to tell Barney, I'm like, Barney, this is, you gave him the permission.
You gave him the microphone, Barn.
You know, you can't rewrite their stuff and make it better. For a long time, when I saw somebody who was talented coming up in stand-up and they would take comedy workshops from me and they were super talented. There's something about their character or their performance skill, just great, but their scripting wasn't anywhere near that. I would go ahead and write them a half hour, an hour of comedy and just give it to them and say, here, go make a living. And they immediately ascended into the comedy ranks, and a few of them made really good money fast because they had an A-level script and A-level performance skills and character. But the script is what people don't mature through quickly.
Right.
And that goes back to the idea of, you know, rhetoric training, I think, gives you a lot of the terminology. It unconflates the environment, even though it wants to reconflate really fast. And trying to take that out to people in a way that maybe through podcasts or through comic books or I don't know, stand up, we can get a little bit of that terminology clear. So they've got a menu at least that doesn't threaten them. They're like, oh, there's more out there to absorb than I know, you know?
Well, you know, this echoes back to speech pedagogy and the way we try to get people to write their own and become very distressed when they don't. And in rail, you know, teaching composition and speech because we want them to have those skills, right? But I've often thought a different pedagogy, and this is the one, of course, the classics use. I have them memorize great speeches. Have them get up and deliver I Have a Dream. Walk in those shoes, you know, feel those rhythms. Will train you, you know, at a more basic level to what does a great speech sound like, and maybe some of that would trickle down into the way. So, I like the idea that maybe these great scripts make, you know, better performers.
Well, in the sophistication of the pedagogy, like in stand up again, I've always drawn a lot of lessons from that back into rhetoric and speech training. Like they'll go night after night into clubs and coffee shops and everything else and just try the same 5 minutes and they rework it. And sometimes they're doing it exactly the same, but you hear the audience and you hear the intonations and you hear all the micro and you learn how to perform it differently. And right. You're also watching another 10, 15 retors, stand-ups get up and you're adapting what they're doing and you're learning from that. And you get that kind of supercharged learning environment where they're only learning a very small slice of public discourse, but I don't ever see that for things like thinking or argument or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
I've wanted to open up a club, not a comedy club, but something just like an interesting club where, you know, no matter what night of the week, you don't have something to do, you're tired of sitting at home. It's like, let's go down to the club, pay.
Like the parties you used to throw, right?
Yeah. You know, just there's going to be something interesting happening on that stage. I don't know what it is, but we're going to like it in some way or another. And just that kind of you know, recapturing of what human beings can do in live environments when you let them talk in interesting ways? Be interesting to, or fun to do.
Well, we have TED Talks, so maybe there's
that became so
damn talks
to me so fast. The whole structure of TED Talks, they all sound alike. Where do they get that intonation? Where they,
yeah, you know, how do you sort, once again, how do you sort through to find the real, the true gems in there? You know, I know I have listened to a few that were pretty enlightening.
Yeah, there were some great ones, but
again, one, like, want to wade into that pool to
Well, cool, man. Once again, super fun. I think the idea of, you know, this adolescence and bringing sophistication to people so they can see something like propaganda, even though it wants to conflate and hide and evade you and all this kind of stuff, I think it's, again, I think it's useful and I enjoy doing it. So there you go.
All right. Well, thank you for having me. Good to talk with you.
Absolutely. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, Rhetoric Files, Rhetorician Files, whatever we're going to call this particular feature. Come back and see us again. Get out there and persuade. As always, people need it.